You are listening to a sermon by Cheryl Pauls, recorded on Sunday, February 16, 2014, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Well, good morning. It is so good to be here with all of you this morning. Dear friends of Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship, my relationship with you as a congregation has been somewhat intermittent, very much intermittent, since I returned to Winnipeg in 1994. Some of you gathered this morning I have never met. Still, as a whole, I call you friends on two levels. One is personal. This congregation walked with me through grad school. What a gift. And secondly, as partnering bodies, this congregation walks alongside CMU, most visibly with budget support. And this happens, I imagine, because you assert the good of a university that calls itself church-related, even as you would consider yourself a church that is university-related, which doesn't always quite follow in the same way, and I would say that those aren't simple reversals, but rather an inversion with a remainder. Clearly, you express that with where you are located here and with the Menno Simon Center, but there are many more reasons. Now, there are reasons why this expression church-related is very important to me. It's a resistance, actually, to calling ourselves faith-based so that CMU doesn't regress into ideological posturing, but rather enacts presence in the mess of the beauty and the messiness of living bodies in relation to God. I'm convinced that these partnerships are imperative so that religion remains free, a free practice in this country, and doesn't concede to privatization, a concern where there is actually something significantly at stake at present. Now, my words this morning combine both personal and partnering dynamics as I respond to the assignment I received from Andre. Here's what he wrote. Time was, even after the Enlightenment, when a sound scientific or liberal arts education went hand in hand with considerable theological influence. Since the modern era, this is substantially absent, particularly in Canada and Europe. Is there hope for the future? One would think the president of CMU would have a better considered opinion than most. Well, I appreciated the call for an opinion rather than a pseudo-sermon lecture in apologetics. Firstly, it's because Mennonites tend to be more interested in embodied expression than apologetics anyway, and this likely has something to do with the fact that the CMU board would put a musician in the role of president. Secondly, so that you as a congregation already appreciate the old story of theology as queen of the sciences and of how theological presence offers gifts of freedom to the libra, the free, in the liberal arts. By the way, I came across a book that I started reading yesterday that I would recommend that's not nearly as droning as most that sort of moves into an apologetics direction. I actually quite highly recommend, even though I've only read two pages, Brad Gregory's The Unintended Reformation, How the 16th Century Reformation Secularized Society. That I think, has lots to offer to that end. Still, you voiced this question. How will we keep persuading others, and even ourselves, of hope for the recovery and resilience of credible theological enchantment? As a response to the yearning in this question, is there hope? Of course, I'll say there's hope. It's part of my job description. To embody, enact, call out, and bear witness to the hope of recovering, reaching for, resting in, and playing from, and I quote, what has been lost and found and lost again and again, and now under conditions that seem unpropitious. We'll leave the engagement with T.S. Eliot's Four Quartets for another time. Want to recognize that Andre also stated I might consider linkages between theological education and secular education in light of some sort of CMU partnership with U of M, if there's any. I realized then that this sermon would actually have to have three distinct parts to it, and it wouldn't be my shortest sermon ever. The first part being something about what CMU does in terms of those kinds of partnerships. Secondly, something that is a little more obviously a sermon. And thirdly, what flows from it. In terms of CMU partnerships in province and so on, I have to say that on the U of M level, there's little that would have substance in a visionary kind of way. Some pragmatic connections in both ways, certainly with some individual faculty, collaborative projects, even with students as well. Very good working relationships with the president and other staff, but otherwise nothing of substance. Actually, rather than pointing to some exemplary approach or even just attempted approach, I want to point to the fact that CMU is actually a very complex organization, but actually seeing a good in our desire to live or to practice a theological imagination in more than one way. And by that I mean that we have, as our main campus, a place where we are nourished in our academic content and our voluntary community, but in ways that are theologically informed and motivated. At the same time, we have Menno Simons College, through which CMU fully funds two departments of University of Winnipeg, those departments in Conflict Resolution Studies and International Development Studies. And there it's an ongoing story as far as how the theological imagination is part of that. There's one sense in which Menno Simons being at U of W has actually strengthened U of W's capacity to consider itself the bastion of social justice and human rights in the city, the province, and wherever else they want to make that claim. This development actually complicates our ongoing voice and relationship. The second thing is that U of W is in transition from being in some ways recognizably a school connected with the United Church to that sort of being increasingly, you know, diminished and more of an indigenous focus, which in some ways includes prayers and ceremonies and so on. And so there's an interesting place there. Maybe thirdly to say that the question of whether peace and social justice are things that we consider to be values that are somehow shared and that represent a transcendence or moving beyond religion, as opposed to virtues that are based in the practice of a theological imagination, is an ongoing and complicated story, and I could expound on more of that, but I'm going to go elsewhere for this morning. I do want to say, though, that CMU as a whole, and this you would see with the Menno Simons dynamics, but also probably primarily as focused through its main campus, offers opportunities where particularities rub off on each other. And I think it's that particularities of different places rubbing off on each other that makes the difference for good in the hope that I see. Now, some of that particularity is actually very much religiously based. The fact that we are Mennonite Church and Mennonite Brethren based, we are actually within the campus as a whole, and Glenn and Katie might want to see if they agree with this, but that in campus, in many ways, the best of both traditions are rubbing off on each other and not the worst. And this is in very healthy ways. And as a result of that, there's an ecumenical health that's really becoming really quite broad. And I think it's because we're not under a single denomination, but have those two starting places. Anglicans say they trust us because we kept Mennonite in our names. Catholics will come to us and say, we feel like we became better Catholics because of the Anabaptist Mennonite influence. Pentecostals say we became better Pentecostals because of the Anabaptist Mennonite influence. We have an ongoing dialogue now moving beyond ecumenism and into interfaith. We have a very strong dialogue with Shia Muslims in Iran. And this is something that has all kinds of interesting political dimensions, and not just in Iran, but here, where CMU actually has more freedom to go into Iran right now than people in most universities in a time when there is no Canadian embassy in Iran. Department of Foreign Affairs tells us, look, the civilian to the civilian stuff, we don't see that as a huge risk. We see it as a good thing. Please keep that dialogue going. But we've been unable to get some of our partners from another Mennonite school that's connected to a large university in a more direct way, in more of an ownership kind of way, or at least a controlling kind of way, and they're not allowed to send their students or faculty there because of this. And so there's actually a greater freedom, and we don't see it as glib that we're going there right now. Like, we do have, you know, good confidence from our from Department of Foreign Affairs, as well as from our partnering people there. And what's interesting in that project is that you've got these Iranian clerics and students, PhD students, coming to CMU because they want to learn peace theology from Christian Mennonites. And so it's just a whole fascinating interchange, and who knows where that's all going. But it's in a place where that particularity of religious practice actually takes us forward. I would also say that there's more and more of a sense, at least we say this, who knows how widespread it is, that the secular is becoming more of a particular thing rather than a presumed openness, and that that's a healthy dimension. Recognize, though, that that's probably still more of a niche understanding, and want to point to a project I read about recently going on here at UBC, some large multi-million dollar SHRC grant for a sociological study on the cultural evolution of religion. And one of the authors there makes the comment that whether or not you believe is the least interesting question about religion. Good researchers simply bracket their beliefs and get to work. And another says, I don't understand how their faith endures after they've gone through the historical research. When you see how sausages are made. Well, yes, precisely, as you'll hear, that's my interest. There's hope in learning and to trust how the sausages are made amidst the grit and the beauty of creatures made in the image of God. Now, the hope of my story, though, I also want to point to some dynamics in province, and there are very different dynamics in each province in terms of how religious entities relate to culture as a whole. Late in fall, I met with the newly appointed Provincial Minister of Advanced Education. Given the opportunity to tell him a little about CMU, I mentioned various areas of teaching strength, but mostly drew connections between the kind of agency we nurture and espouse with educational distinctives and the school's operations. I spoke of a relatively collective commitment of faculty and staff to a remuneration scale based in principles of justice. Effectively, this means a lower ratio between the highest and lowest paid employees than is common, and a scale with which we express a hope to make a dent against the grain of increasing rift between rich and poor in society. I was careful to minimize what I call the piety factor and mentioned how commitments to justice today build on, but also differ from, more sacrificial modes of operating and living that were common in the 1940s when the two colleges of CMU were formed. I think this guy was so shocked that I didn't just yell at him that we get far less money than any of the other universities. And so he just kept asking questions. He was just totally flabbergasted by my results. And he just said, what do you read? How did you learn to think that way? Well, what to say? The Bible? I've been mentored by the Klan? Muttered this and that, but we had a great conversation. Needless to say, I was streetwise enough to know what to say to an NDP minister, and in such a way that CMU will remain at the table in the public universities at present. As for how I learned to think this way, I'll begin with the book of Nehemiah. I don't recall ever spending any time pondering the story of Nehemiah. That is not until recently, when Nehemiah showed up at my door three times within a two-week period, in a book, a talk, and another book, none of them linked. I wouldn't quite call it serendipitous that these three takes on Nehemiah happened my way all at once, but it seemed reason enough to sit down and read the book for myself. The story of Nehemiah goes basically like this. In the month of Chislev, in the 20th year of I'm not sure what, the storyteller, Nehemiah, son of Hakaliah, and cupbearer, which is code for primary advisor, to King Artaxerxes of Persia, was visited by his brother Hanani, who delivered this message: the wall of Jerusalem has broken down and its gates destroyed by fire. When Nehemiah heard this, he sat down and wept, and mourned for days, fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Then Nehemiah took up the courage to ask the king for a leave and went back to Jerusalem and amassed person upon person upon person to rebuild the wall. Together they restored the welfare of the city. Now the three takes on Nehemiah that happened upon me each looked in on the story differently. One author defined his career through a series of institutions that went from flailing to flourishing. Another focused on the materials used to rebuild the wall, stones recovered from heaps of burnt rubbish, and new timber. My reading? Well, the plot line occupies a total of about three verses. The rest of the 13 chapters consists of name after name after name after name of the people who labored from the break of dawn until the stars came out. Like the sons of Hassanah, who built the fish gate, laid its beams, set up its bolts and its bars. While next to them, Meshulam, son of Berechiah, made repairs. And while Uziel, one of the goldsmiths, made repairs. And Nahaniah, one of the perfumers, made repairs. And next to them, Rephaiah, son of Hur, made repairs. Next to them, Jehiah, son of Harumphah, made repairs opposite his house. Next to him, Hattush, son of Hashabaniah, and next to him, Shalom, son of Halahesh, made repairs. He, and, believe it or not, his daughters. Now, I imagine you've guessed where I'm going. I'm about to describe the dearth of theological influence within liberal arts and science as a broken wall and call each of us to a particular task within a collaborative restoration project. Certainly, I'm persuaded hope lies in the dimensions of who, but I won't spell out a what, just tell my story. Before we go there, there's another huge crack in the wall. Scarcely a day goes by when a news flash doesn't cross my desk in one form or other, proclaiming that the study of the arts, humanities, and even sciences aren't worth anything close to what a degree costs to the student and the state. In response to this assessment, we see a surge of writings demonstrating with substance and stats the superior quality of life achieved through university grads schooled in the kinds of things liberal arts do, including employment opportunities, lifelong earnings, capacity to navigate a changing world, contributions as citizens for the sake of the good of the whole. But the cumulative effect of all the public discourse on the university rarely takes the form of good dialogue. Rather, it resembles a nattering catfight, one side playing offense, the other defense. The result? Both are losers. With the public dialogue more than the actual conditions looking like a broken wall, it's hard to conjure the will to enter the fray. But I have a question for you. If we accept that the theological voice within the liberal arts has become substantially absent, and if we also accept that the liberal arts, and to a lesser extent the sciences, are to some degree nonsensical within society's most dominant collective imagination, can we make a case that the absence of the theological is in some way relevant to why the liberal arts seem so pointless to many? And by bringing together these two losses, can the double negative generate a positive answer? If so, can a theological imagination be reignited with agency in collaboration with the arts, humanities, and sciences as a credible way of knowing and engaging the world's dreams and its suffering in the academy and beyond? This is not an assertion, it's a confession, one in which I invite you to join me as we reach for and rest in the biblical story. Here we go. Greetings to all. My name is Johanna, and I have come bearing witness to the light that has come. I am not myself the light, but I have come to bear witness to the light. You'll find my story in the second gospel, the one according to Mark, chapter 5, verses 24 to 34. Although when you look it up, you'll notice my name is missing from the account, along with several other bits I'm about to reveal. I'm not totally sure why Mark left out this stuff. Probably he was trying to save paper and the planet and all. Oops, with that reference, you're liable to try and date me. No, not in that way. To date me as in put me in my place and limit my voice to the early 21st century. And if you do that, you'll miss out big time. For I am a transgenerational being who floats around in time and place. One day, almost 2,000 annual cycles ago, a large crowd followed Jesus and pressed in on him. Everyone wanted a piece of him in one form or other. I was no different. The story on the street was that I had been suffering from hemorrhages for 12 years. The story should have been that I looked as if I had been suffering from hemorrhages. I always appeared pale, tired, and strained. The fatigue was partly an act. I felt I had to look tired so that everyone would think I took my job seriously, worked harder than anyone else, and had a true appreciation for the gravity of the words I spoke. And partly the weariness was real. I was always anxious. I struggled to find the nerve to speak of the light of God in reference to any pressing matter without a painstaking commentary about the grounds on which I dared to make a halfway credible statement on what we think we share and understand as people who live in the light of God's law. I couldn't seem to spin or spit out a thought without a rambling preamble such as, perhaps in some small and ever partial, but never impartial way, we might consider viewing the very complicated so-called notion of blah, blah, blah. Listen to this one from a Sunday evening in 1992. As I sit at the piano during this Abend music service, the music is beautiful, intriguing to me. But all I can make of this practice of resting in God is some nice, soft, comforting, boxed-off fantasy oasis that doesn't come close to touching the chorus of voices citing evidence that the church is nothing but a crumbling fortress with little capacity to live out or live into a future with hope, its song overridden by cataclysmic proportions of poverty and pain alongside new developments in human identity, technology, and culture. Writing those droning sentences was totally draining. Over the years, they only got worse. I'd heard about Jesus bringing healing, clarity, and lightness. So one summer day, I went to a gathering where 800 people were pressing in on him to ask him what he thought was the right thing to do with one of the rather complex matters of the time. In truth, I couldn't figure out how this was an honest question and couldn't imagine that Jesus would be inclined to respond without a few other witnesses in the room. But who was I to judge these people who were so earnest in their walk with Jesus? That evening, a strange thing happened. We were asked to stand and sing, along with a very fine jazz combo. Each player loved God dearly, and it seemed this group had a chance of drawing together the hearts and voices of that diverse audience. But half the people didn't sing. Not only that, they didn't even stand or pretend to sing along with the crowd. Do you want to know what they're doing? It's okay. I'm out of character for my day job, so I'm free to talk. They were sitting in the pews and moving their thumbs on little contraptions as if acts of worship were superfluous to the truth we were asking Jesus to teach us. The only sense I could make of it was that these people thought they already knew what Jesus had to say. I suppose that was my attitude too. After all, I was just faking it as I sang along. I was desperate to sing, but also felt wounded, bored, self-righteous, lost maybe. Was also short of breath and in a panic about how I'd ever find a way to jump into the theological double dutch game in which we seemed to be playing. As I labored through the final refrain of a well-worn song, suddenly something happened. For a moment, time stood still, and a stream of stunning beauty slipped out of the song and through my whole being. It felt as if I felt like Jesus felt when the crowds pressed in on him and he became distracted by the surge of energy that flowed from his body. The only, though rather substantive, difference between Jesus and me was that I felt the hope and healing enter and awaken my body rather than depart from it. Looking back, I can see that with my half-hearted singing, I had been reaching out for Jesus. Good habits can do that, sometimes even when we think we're just going through the motions. Immediately, my tongue was loosened and my breath restored. I was eager to bear witness to the lightness that had come. Surely we all had heard some measure of that lightness and light as we sang and could follow the star through to where Jesus was alive and kicking. But what to say without getting the same bewildered looks that Jesus got when he asked, "Who touched my cloak?" In a class, if we were to sing, "The Lord is King, let the heavens ring," and if at that word ring, both time and tone were suspended in a foregone conclusion brilliantly displaced in a way that sounds almost, but not quite, sentimental, I might say, "Nice Narnia moment." From there, I would get into the history of word painting in relation to musical matters of time and acoustics, and how their properties do and do not ascribe to physical laws like gravity, and how fine-tuned calculations of these matters can play on listener expectations and induce experiences of humor, spellbound transcendence, and good change. But we weren't in class, so I scrapped all the really interesting technical stuff and went with the Narnia moment. What's a Narnia moment, you ask? Simply, it's a twist of imagination that's interesting enough or needed sorely enough to entice you to follow it through. It invites you beyond some foregone conclusion in one sphere of reference and opens your heart and imagination to suspend judgment in some other realm. You might begin in a song, a forest, a wardrobe, or the thick and the thin of any complex matter. You go until it finds you drinking deeply from a wellspring of grace and truth. You can look for Narnia moments to a point, but mostly you're found by them. I'll even say transformed by them when you see some new norm taking shape in your everyday life. Narnia moments are rarely one-stop quick fixes. Mostly you're found by them as you recognize a growing inclination to be nourished by the biblical story in relationship with the persons and the people of the triune God. As for the time when Jesus touched me, I saw him look around to see who had reached for him. I knew it was me, given all that had happened. I came in fear and trembling and fell down before him. I told him the whole truth of how I'd been delighting in Scripture by writing Midrash-type monologues on the biblical story, and along the way been infused with gifts of courage, patience, and desire to imagine new openings to conversations that otherwise appeared closed and marked by despair. Then Jesus said, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and joy, for you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water, whose waters never fail." As I've taken up this practice of writing monologues, and some of them are more multimedia and so on, one of my colleagues says, "Can you write some essays on what you think you're doing?" Well, this one's not as complex as some of the others, but I will want to take you in three ways. The first is personal, the journey of delighting in Scripture and liturgical ritual, and how learning to rest and reach in God. This is the gift of voice to which I give testimony, and this I simply recommend. Tell stories through the biblical text and watch what happens. The second part has to do with the story of the Ring of Truth, trusting some musical moment as trustworthy. That's coming more from what I share as someone who's done work between music and theology in some ways, and I'll talk a little bit about that for these last few minutes. The third was, on what did some sound musicality offer blessing, or at least render open with patience and joy? And there, I'll just right at the end give you one or two statements which are really quite key to some of my current work in this President's Act. And hopefully that can, or this might open up possibilities for something we might look at in our discussion time this morning. But to focus first, or here, on the interdependence and collaboration of music and theology, or various studies of disciplines, sometimes including theology as one of them, not necessarily, in order to negotiate impasses. There is a tradition of sound truth as measured through musicality, an assessment of what's credible, present, desirable, and urgent. I do want to say that I'm appropriately suspicious of interdisciplinary and transdisciplinary work. Are we really ever working in both at once, or simply transferring terms through metaphor? My approach is actually to make the metaphor work in some sort of recursive process by going back and forth between fields of engagement. This music theology tradition in today's voice I encountered a while back in this sentence from a group of authors who, and this was from an introductory essay in a book entitled Radical Orthodoxy. They define theological truth as similar to, but a better story than contemporary secular nihilism on account of theology's proposal of the rational possibility and the faithfully perceived actuality of an indeterminacy that is not impersonal chaos, but infinite interpersonal harmonious order in which time participates. Now, as an avant-garde player who dabbles in music theory and theology, I took the statement and said, you mean you consider theological truth to be better than secular nihilism because it sings, because theological truth is musical? I said, but consider the dysfunctions in church music alone, let alone all kinds of other places in culture. The notion of the church as a priesthood of all believers that sings in harmony is a profoundly strained ideal. Now, this notion of theological credibility through music is something we sing about all the time, something that makes belief believable, desirable. You could consider easier to understand examples than that introductory sentence, such as, over my head, I hear music everywhere, there must be a God somewhere. Or, I sang of heaven, and the earth sang. Or, when you sing along about the clear of midnight's glorious song of old, which parts do you sing most fervently? About a weary world of sorrow, suffering long, 2,000 years of war and strife and wrong? Or of that time when comes round the age of gold, when peace shall over all the earth its ancient splendors fling, and the whole world send back the song which now the angels sing? This peace-flinging metaphor is one that I've played with a fair bit in trying to work with peace as a virtue and not merely a value. What's fascinating to me is that that Christmas carol, while it has found its way into wholehearted Christian embrace, was penned by a Unitarian minister. And this is part of sort of this rubbing back and forth between various places of religious or not explicitly religious engagement that I called earlier. In any case, that long, somewhat complicated radical orthodoxy sentence, I went ahead and called it a burden summation with a trailing addendum. That is, the trailing addendum, not quite knowing what to do with time. And then proceeded to write a very cumbersome essay myself, in which the strongest aspect is the title, Harmony in Exile, Rest in Its Embers. I introduced the tension, the struggle around this notion of theology being a better story than the secular world through music, through the strain in music, rather than through what is an ideal of beauty. And I entered it through music in the church, but found actually the way forward through what my own work in avant-garde music that we might call relativistic from the 1960s. And the whole question that I struggled with when I did my doctoral work here at UBC on notions of virtue and virtuosity. How does a person play the rest? How does a person make musical decisions when there isn't some sort of clarity about what sort of narrative to play into, how to find a pulse, what could be a line, and so on? And as I was doing that work, or actually more recently when I started working more theologically with some of those ideas, I came across a music theorist who referred to music of that same composer and era as an historical flat space, completely without temporal perspective, a barrage of immediacy, a despairing, exhilarating confession that there is no believable hierarchy of musical styles left. When I read that, I asked this question. Precisely what do music theorists do with confessions? So decided to make a problem of considering a confession to be an essence, but rather to approach it as a liturgical act, something we can do, something we practice. Went from there to take this sense of this sort of play of despair and exhilaration being together with long-term narratives and music of madness and promise, suffering and joy, and so on, and define them through liturgical acts of lament and hope, both of which are hope, reaching for and resting in something beyond ourselves, a mystery we call God. With that, I was able, I found, to find a way that through that liturgical notion of confessing all you lament, all you know, all you think you know, as a way of practicing, and then performance as a time when you choose for a moment what to listen for, and so on. won't bore you with all the details of that, but what was incredible to me was that I actually found a way forward from thinking that this despairing, exhilarating confession of sort of this wash of nothingness was the final answer in the approach to the music, but rather that this notion of performance and practice took us somewhere. And where I got with this performance and practice was that our strain on how we use the word service in terms of religious practice. Often we're strained about, is the real work what happens in church in the ritual, or the real work with the church scattered in everyday life? And what the beauty of this is that there's a difference between that and what we tend to assume with music performance. With music performance, we tend to assume that practice is something that's preliminary to performance, and performance is somehow the real thing. But with liturgical practice, there's the sense that what we do as a gathered community is a practice for the performance of what life is. And what we do in everyday life is a practice for the performance of worship. And we can find order, and in fact, we practice order, we enact order as we move from confession to offering and those kinds of acts. And so there is room for order, but there isn't a hierarchically defined right order to that. And that freedom to move between this is a practice to the performance of life, and life is a practice for the performance of worship, and allowing ourselves to engage in both is something that I find incredibly freeing, first of all, around many of the hang-ups that we might have in the church as far as where's the real work of the church. It also helped me with sort of this despairing, exhilarating notion of what this so-called relativistic music was, that the liturgical act of finding a way into it actually brought about better musical expression. And so that, you know, that's just one example, and don't be concerned, I won't, you know, bore you with more of that. But just to say that that real engagement back and forth with the metaphors between the disciplines actually allowed me to find ways forward in both. And I do think that there's lots of room by giving theological imagination and liturgy some sort of persuasive presence within other disciplines. To end, though, what was blessed with that Narnia moment? Well, really, it came in the middle of... I won't explain the details of what went on musically. It is something that was actually fairly simple and almost passé, but it was just I was so bored that I clung to something that was really quite striking in the moment. And but what it did was it allowed me to take this notion of the Lord is King, let the heavens ring, that God is not here blessing what we think we're seeing. Rather, this blessing is what's been blown open here. And there was something healthy about finding the blessing in what's been blown open rather than the blessing of whatever we were saying in that moment. Clearly, this was in the midst of a conference that was dealing with human sexuality in our time. And this really gave me the courage in a new way to be present in the messy middle of a radically destabilized binary of male and female in our own era, and to do so with courage, trust, grace, and patience. Now, for me right now, that conversation is one that is happening in multiple spheres. It's happening within the church in all kinds of forms. It's also happening at the inter-university level. And in both places, there is a strain on another binary right now, the authority of church and state. And that one I am attempting to try to find a way to get to between what I would call secular confessions of some sort of higher standard that's going to adjudicate where tensions amongst various freedoms of the Canadian Charter come out. It's also, though, a certain the tension of that secular confession with the church's confessions where the struggle is to see that freedom not as preserving fixed understandings, but rather releasing what we think we understand into the biblical text, into the liturgy, and into the persons and the people of the triune God. There's a lot at stake in that question, is there hope? My sense right now, though, and it grows from all these understandings that I brought together this morning, is that in many ways, the hope that I'm experiencing and that I believe I share with you is in some ways vulnerable, but not victim. Many angles, many places of open conversation are happening. And for you, is there hope? Friends, your faith has made you well. Go in peace and joy, for you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail.